Hello, curiosity seekers. Welcome to Dissecting Medical History. I'm Ange. I'm a travel nurse, medical history enthusiast, and your host. If you're looking for a storytelling formatted podcast with fun and fascinating topics on history and bios, then you are in the right spot. Please note this is not in any way medical advice. If you have anything that's ever discussed in any of the podcast episodes, please seek medical attention. Now, let's get this story started. Hello and happy new year, listeners. I have with me today, Viv, again.
Yay! Hi.
I love having you and I'm glad you're back. Happy new year.
Happy new year. Thank you for having me.
It's going to be a better year. My mom and I decided that so far, it doesn't feel like a new year, but maybe the new year starts with the Chinese New Year and not the Western New Year.
So possibly.
Maybe things will change on February 12th when things are like, I don't know what comes after the year of the rat. I don't remember. But whatever it is, it has to be better than the year of the rat. Which I am a rat. And so they say that your year is technically not your best year for some reason. It's supposed to be more challenging.
Oh, and I would have thought the opposite. Maybe the challenging for growth, I guess.
I don't know. But that's what I always thought. And then when I was reading about it last year, it said that the year of your year is technically not your best year. So I'm like, well, that makes sense because it was a pretty crappy year. So that's okay. And got through it. I'm alive. You're alive. But I thought, well, maybe there is something to this Chinese New Year. Because my troubles actually started around the beginning of the Chinese New Year last year is when I got sick. So I'm wondering.
Maybe. It has, I don't know. I feel like, for me, it feels different. It feels like, well, I guess we got a little bit to wrap up on of 2020, but otherwise it feels like things are good. I feel positive.
Yeah, no, not yet. I had a couple of bad news things that happened the last few days, so no, not yet. I'm still waiting for my year to start.
Oh, okay.
But that's okay. It's okay. It's all right. Today, we're going to talk about a murderer rather than an ailment. The murderer is a doctor. So we're going to do like a true crime type episode today.
Okay.
And it's kind of not too far off. I mean, okay, it's far off from the Typhoid Mary. Typhoid Mary was getting people sick and she was just adamant that she didn't know she was getting people sick, right? She didn't believe in it, but other people were trying to tell her that she was. In this case, this doctor has strong beliefs in her regimen and is killing people. She's a serial killer, but she doesn't think she's doing anything wrong. She's never admitted it anyway. So she she's not even a real doctor. She got her license from a loophole in the system in Washington State. So she's not technically a doctor, but she does have a license to practice what's called the fasting cure. It's a fad, like other, you know, like they even have fast today.
And so, what time frame is this doctor from?
She was born in 1868.
Okay.
But the majority of her work was from like 1903, 1902 to the 1930s. This lady's name is Linda Burfield Hazard. She was born in 1868 in Minnesota. She was the oldest of seven children. And grew up with a family that mostly believed in vegetarianism. Her stepfather was adamant that the children see a medical doctor. He wanted to make sure that they prevented illness rather than just be seen when they were ill. Mm-hmm. However, that had some pretty ill effects because the doctor that he had see the children were saying that the children had intestinal parasites. So they were given these blue pills to take, and the blue pills would make them vomit and have diarrhea. And this went on for years. So it kind of damaged Linda's internal organs a little bit.
Wow.
So she ended up having most of her life to depend on the enemas. She called them internal baths. So she pretty much had to do enemas in order to have to defecate because the doctor messed her up. Uh-huh. Also, she lost many of her teeth because of the calomel, I think it was called. It's a powder that causes vomiting. Mm-hmm. I think it has mercury in it. And so it was destroying her teeth as well. So she wasn't in the greatest of health in the beginning of her life. Or I think it was after 10 years old is when it started. And so I think that's one of the reasons she became this advocate or this doctor of natural care, natural cures and homeopathic type things and fasting, and was a huge believer in enemas. She got married when she was 18 to a 14-year-old named Irwin Perry. They had two kids, Roland and Nina Floyd. And it's unclear what happened to Irwin. It was said that he left her, but she also wasn't happy to be married either, so it could have been she left him. But after the divorce in 1902, she kept her maiden name, and the kids went off to her grandmother, to their grandmothers, her mother, mm-hmm. so that she could follow her career. So she didn't even raise her children. Her mother did. She ended up going to nursing school in osteopathology in 1898. She was trained to be an osteopath. An osteopath is a branch of medical practice that emphasizes the treatment of medical disorders through manipulation and massage of the bones, joints, and muscles. Mm-hmm. So pretty much it's like a massage therapy school.
Is it a chiropractor?
Kind of. But it's yes and no. I don't know to what extent mm-hmm. they were going, because like chiropractic does a lot of manipulation and that kind of stuff. So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But it's along the same lines.
Yeah. I wonder if it was like the beginning is that, because I don't know the history of
chiropractic. Yeah. I don't.
Because I know with the natural, that's also like, because some people really are for chiropractors. I like that. I like adjustments. I just also know that you have to do stretches and stuff with your adjustments. But it for some people who don't like it, it's for claims like it can cure cancer if you're aligned in the right way or whatever. So I don't know. Like, I wonder how that's related, like with her beliefs.
It kind of is, because she feels that's part of the treatment for curing just about everything, mm-hmm. along with fasting and exercise. So yeah, she had that belief, but I'm not, like I said, I don't know, but I think you're right. I think it probably is the beginning of chiropractic medicine. Mm-hmm. And so it probably has a lot to do with it. Anyway, she was learning from this guy named Dr. Dewey, who wrote a book called The Gospel of Health and the No Breakfast Plan that went on about the benefits of fasting. She studied under him, and even though they didn't see eye to eye on everything, she learned a lot, and they kept in contact with each other until he died. He believed that the bowels should relieve themselves, function naturally. She believed that the body needed the enemas.
That's such a weird, like, that should be a red flag right there, where if everything should be natural, why are you needing something external to?
Well, she does, because her interns were ruined by these magic blue pills.
Yeah. Right? But it's just like, why, the hypocrisy not necessarily hypocrisy, the contradiction, like, how do you not catch it? Like, oh, this is what I believe. It's all, and we should natural and whatnot, but yet you have to get your own, you got to get an outside source to help you have a bowel movement.
I think too that, I mean, the body is not like it's not a new thing. People have been defecating for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And now suddenly.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah. It's sad that it, like, for someone to come to that belief where they're like, oh, I know the right way. And it's actually, it tops all the years of evolution.
Right. Yeah. I agree. I agree completely. And like, I bring this up all the time. As a nurse in the hospital, there's people that swear their day is ruined if they don't have a bowel movement. They have to be, they'll be like, I haven't had a bowel movement today. I need an enema. Like, you need an enema. Yes. If they're not completely regular, it's usually the older generation that gets fixated on it.
Yeah.
They have to have something to help them go. And although we do want people to have bowel movements, especially if it's been a couple days or if it's been after surgery, want to make sure the bowels are moving. Mm-hmm. But to be all worried about it when you're stuck in a hospital bed, you're not moving very much, and the body kind of slows itself down, which mm-hmm. includes your intestinal system. Mm-hmm. It slows down and it doesn't work like it normally would if you're up and about moving. Mm-hmm. And so but these people get so worried about having their bowel movement.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's like, it's based in fear. So sometimes we don't see that someone is afraid. It just comes off as like, annoying, but we're like, oh, it's because you're actually afraid. Okay. It could be more understanding.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, they get caught up on that. But anyway, okay. Back to Linda. So she opened up her own practice in Minneapolis and was doing quite well. And she started to call herself Dr. Burfield. Well, her first victim was possibly a 41-year-old stroke victim. She was unable to use her left limbs, and she was desperate for a cure. And most people that came to see Linda, I'm going to call her Linda because I don't feel like she deserves to be called doctor. Most people went to her as a last resort. They've gone to other places, other medical doctors. They've gone to other treatments, and they all kind of come to her as a last resort, which this lady had done as well. And her name was Miss Young, and she ended up doing this cure. The doctor said they were going to put her on a 40-day fast and that she would be cured of her paralysis. And she died on day 39. She didn't make it to day 40.
Oh, my goodness.
But she was very strict with her on her diet, and the patient's doctor friend was very adamant that she needed more food and was like, no, Dr. Burfield said that I have to wait until day 40. And she was very adamant, and they were so sure that it was going to work. And that's usually what happens when you're desperate. You want to believe so badly, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Burfield, Linda, she put on the death certificate that she died of paralysis. But her doctor friend, the patient's doctor friend, he happened to be a coroner. So he looked at the body, did an autopsy, and found, no, she died of starvation, changed the cause of death, and said that Linda should get in trouble for this, right? Mm-hmm. Well, she didn't get in trouble. she was not charged with any crimes. Because I think because the patient kind of did it to herself in a way.
Oh, man. Yeah.
The other thing was that her jewelry was never recovered. That disappeared. And that seems to be a theme that goes on with Linda. She treats people that give her money or give her stuff, and then it just disappears. But anyway, that might be her first victim. In 1903, Linda married a man who happened to already be married under a different name. His name was Sam Hazard. He married the other woman under, I think it was Hargrove or something. But he changed his name because he went to West Point. He was teaching. He was doing really well, making lots of money, and started living above his means. And so that kind of caught up with him. He had a wife at that point. And then he kind of left her. He deserted her and the military, said he couldn't come back. So he owed the government and he owed all of these people in New York money for like even things like fixing his wife's bicycle or some suits or clothing or whatever. So he ended up fleeing. He changed his name. I think he went to Texas, then he went to Minneapolis where he met another girl and then married her under this false name, Hargrove or whatever it was, and then met Dr. Linda Burfield and then married her. Well, then the wife found out, the second wife found out, and then the father, who was a senator, kind of persuaded her to press charges. And so he ended up doing time for bigamy. So the government finally found out where he was, because like I said, he changed his name.
Mm-hmm.
He got charged with 1.5 years in prison. He got charged with bigamy, but was to spend 1.5 years in prison. And so the government was like, oh, he's already in prison. So they kind of dropped it. And so he served out his time in 1.5 years.
And so then didn't have to pay any money? Or
like, I guess not. I don't know how that ended up working.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And so the second wife waited around for him because he was writing her love letters. And apparently he was a really good looking guy. And she fell for it, was waiting for him. But as soon as he got out, he went straight to Linda.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even, oh, a poor girl. Like, she's sitting there waiting for him for 1.5 years. And so he went to Linda because he was ambitious. Linda was ambitious. She was wanting to be this doctor who created a sanitarium empire like the Kellogg's. So, so yeah, he hitched his wagon to her.
It's because he's a con man, right? He's a con man.
Yep, they both are.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
Found each other. So that was the last of the other girl. In 1905, when Sam got out of jail, he went with Linda, and they opened an office or whatever together. They were working together. But in 1907, they ended up moving to Seattle. And I'm not sure why they ended up moving there. I don't know if it was for family or whatnot, but they ended up going to Seattle and they found this land in Olala. I don't know how to say it. It's Olalla in Washington. It's like on this island or this, well, I think it's a peninsula. It's this peninsula, but you had to get like a ferry to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, so they found some land and settled down in there in this little village. And it was quite beautiful, had a good view of the water and that kind of scenery. So Linda, she really believed in her fasting cure. It was the perfect recipe for murder. There was faddists, like, sisters from England, Dora and Claire Williamson. They were perfect for such quackery because they were always looking for that next natural fix. They were always feeling like they were not well. They were well. They were very healthy, very little to complain about, but they were very rich women. They were heiresses, orphaned, nothing better to do but travel around the country, around the world. And I think when they felt something inside that didn't feel right, that it had to be fixed. They felt like they had to be perfect, and they didn't see anyone else complaining of their ailments. So they thought, well, other people are perfect, but we're not. So that was constantly their mentality for this faddist kind of way of life. And they had been going to other places for treatment. And they even talked about going to that Kellogg's sanitarium in Battle Creek. Mm-hmm. But they decided that it was too far and inconvenient. And I'm sure that they wished they had at some point, because this became far more inconvenient. So when the girls were in Vancouver, Canada, they saw a newspaper article about this Linda's book. She had written a book called Fasting for the Cure of Disease, as she wrote in 1908. And they wrote to her and asked for her book, said, Claire wrote the letters, and she was a little bit more of the naive one. And she kind of played it up like her and her sister were sicker than they really were in order to get maybe the attention that she was looking for. Mm-hmm. So she got the book and they read it, like Claire read it over and over and over again from what her sister said. But they were very interested in doing this treatment. And so they wrote to her and said, well, our sanitarium isn't ready yet, but it will be soon or whatever. So the girls decided to go visit family in California. And they did so for months. And then they kept being put off by this doctor saying, no, we're still not ready yet, but soon. And so they did go see another doctor in Riverside, California, that was doing some weird massaging to her and sticking these cotton balls in her vagina that had some caustic kind of, I know by your face that, yeah. It was
like, what?
Yeah, it was some cotton ball filled antiseptic that they would stick up there, and it's like, oh, no, this is good for your uterus. Someone had told her uterus was up against her spine, and that was causing her problems. And so the stuff that she was putting in there, she's doing like 3 times a week, didn't feel so good. It was kind of hurting a little bit, burning. And so she had written to Linda, and Linda said, stop this treatment. You know, you should start the fasting when you can, and blah, blah, blah. And she was charging for all of this advice too. She would send her the advice, stop doing that. And then she would enclose a bill for like $5 or whatever she felt was her advice was worth at that moment. Mm-hmm. So she would start. And so they were abiding by it. They were trying to do the fasting. However, because they were visiting with family, it was difficult to do, because when you're with other people, when you're traveling around, it's really difficult to follow a diet regimen, right? Mm-hmm. So it was hard for them to do that. However, they were trying a little bit, just not to the extent of what was in the book or what they were doing later. They ended up finally coming to Seattle. The doctor, Linda, was telling them to come to an apartment and that they would start the treatment there and then move on to the sanitarium. So that's what they did. They started there first. I should say, they were very sneaky. When they sent them the book, they snuck in a brochure for the sanitarium. That's how they found out about the sanitarium, with the description of the trees and the beautiful scenery. And that's what they got their hooks on when they, because Claire really wanted to be outdoors and thought that was going to be the cure. That was going to be the ticket. Mm-hmm. So it's very clever advertising. And they advertised, he advertised even all over the world. There was people from New Zealand and England that had heard about this treatment. So it's pretty clever. And when you have someone come across the world to do a treatment like that, it's easier to hide the evidence. Like, it's harder to figure out what happened to your loved one when they're across the country, right?
Yeah, that and when you travel so far, you're like, you want it. It's just like that hope again, where you're like, you want it so much to be true. The more you give to it, the more work you put it, or more time you put into it, the more you're probably not going to leave it. You know, you're going to keep
already invested so much.
Yeah, investing.
Well, also the girls, I think at this point we're thinking of her as a celebrity. Like, they kind of had this starstruckness when they met her, and the doctor was going on and on about all the successful stories that she had had, all these people that she'd cured. And so it's hard to think anything bad could happen, because look at all the good that she's done.
Yeah, it's sad. It's because the setup for the sisters, it's like, they're looking for something to believe in, and that's like prime for cult mentality, like that celebrity and everything to follow blindly.
Exactly. So, and in Seattle, they went to the doctor's office and they started the treatment right then and there. But the doctor didn't do an examination. She said she wanted to do the fast first and get rid of toxins and see what they were going to be dealing with after that. Well, obviously, you know, a good doctor, any doctor, would examine a patient first. They just took the word of what the girls had said was their problem. And remember, I said they exaggerated their problems. They were saying that they were worse than they really were. Mm-hmm. So the doctor is just taking their word that someone else examined them and knew and said this. And that happened a lot for her. She would take on a patient and she would tell when they ended up dying, she would say, well, the doctor before them said that she had this, and she wasn't being forthcoming with how bad it really was. And she died from that, not from the starvation. Mm-hmm. Well, Linda started the treatment with getting them on a fast, telling them that they needed to rest their digestive systems. And her belief was that all Americans ate way too much. And they still do.
Well, I'm sure it's it's crazy. Okay, that makes me think, like, you start off with a lie and then somewhere down the line it becomes the truth. Like, people just believe it and adopt it. Like, our serving sizes have gotten larger and larger as we've gotten better with, just creating new things and our resources and whatnot. So, yeah. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, Linda, telling her stories of all these successes, was described as giving a sermon when she spoke. Like, she was just very loud and persuasive and just like this doctor in a pulpit. She was just giving them all these stories and they were just eating it up. So they did start right away. The treatment was to be 3 to 4 weeks of fasting with vigorous exercise several times a day, and with the osteo treatments. The broth that they would eat should be the finest of tomatoes. But they used canned tomatoes quite a bit and just didn't tell the girls.
Wow. Oh, such a con artist. Like, this is... Okay.
The broth was to be reduced from a quart of water to a pint. The was supposed to be strained and no seasoning at all. They were to only have a cup of broth twice a day. Later on, they could add asparagus to it and then include orange juice once in the morning. The osteo treatments were fists that were pounded into the girl's stomach, head, and foreheads, and they started the treatment like that day.
What?
Stripped them down to their skibbies and started, like, fists pounding on them. Yes.
Okay. So the difference between sociopath and psychopath, is she a sociopath? And did it happen because she, like, her gut was so messed up and she was just completely, you know, like, is there any relation to that since we're finding serotonin in the gut and stuff?
I think she truly felt like she was helping. Mm. However, in this case and some of the other cases, I think she knew what she was doing. I think she really knew that she was starving them to death. Because, as I will point out later, I think it had a financial gain for her. So where she might have helped someone who was local in the community, she may not have killed them. She was doing the fast in order to help them, because at one point she would stop the fast and introduce more foods or whatever, and they did feel better. I don't know if it was a cure.
Are you saying, like, the ends justify the means to kill people that had a lot more?
No, I'm just saying that I think she really thought she was helping people. But in certain circumstances, she knew how to kill them in order to get financial gain. So she wasn't killing everybody. She wasn't doing it because she liked killing. She was doing it because she was trying to get more money in order to have a better sanitarium. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't doing it like some murderers will do murder because they like the murder. She wasn't doing it because she wanted to murder. She was doing it because she was able to get money out of these people.
So it's still a murderer though. Like, right.
But whether it's a sociopath or a psychopath or whatever you could be a
sociopath, not want to kill, but be okay with killing and not feel any sympathy for it.
Then she's probably along that line. She didn't feel bad at all. In fact, she was annoyed when one of the sisters died.
Oh my goodness.
Wished she had never met them, those pesky girls. Anyway, so that was the fast part. And then the treatments, like I said, were the fist pounding. And then there was the enema treatments that started. Those were started about half an hour, about 6 quarts of water. And then they ended up being hours long. She called them internal baths. Hours and hours.
I don't even take a regular bath for hours.
Yeah. they got so weak that they didn't really have much choice. And one of the nurses had said the water was so hot, the nurse couldn't even touch it.
Oh my God.
And what? So, yeah.
Like the damage being done inside just in general. Oh my God. Okay. This is a horror movie.
It really is.
It has inspired different horror movies, and I can't think of one right now.
Well, it didn't take long for the girls to get really weak from the lack of food. So they were starting to pass out within the first week. Just start walking, and then they'd pass out. Linda had nurses come over and check on them. As they were getting weaker and weaker, they needed pretty much around-the-clock care because they couldn't do anything for themselves. And they started putting them in separate rooms almost immediately. It was easier to manipulate them if they weren't together, if they couldn't walk to each other. Claire became the first one that couldn't really walk very much at all. And the other thing was they could keep their stuff separated. They couldn't get to each other's things. So the nurses that would come over, I think they did feel things were not great. I think they felt guilty a little bit. One of the neighbors, she wasn't a nurse, but she would come over and help. One of the nurses had asked her to look at the stuff that came out of the enema. It was kind of like this milky white. She's like, what do you think this is? Like, the nurse didn't know. And the neighbor was like, I don't know. And the neighbor also saw the treatment that Linda was giving them, like pounding on them and hitting them. So she got to witness in some of that as well. One of the lackeys that Linda had was this kid named Webb, and he would come in and help with their baths while he was doing some sexually deviant things to Dora.
Oh my gosh, why? Okay.
Because she would have flashbacks later, but she would pass out. They passed out a lot, especially when the water was so hot. They'd put him in the baths and then she'd wake up with him touching her. So there was that as well. The girls were just getting weaker and weaker to the point where they finally were able to go to Linda's home. They said, oh, the sanitarium's ready. You can come now, blah, blah, blah. So the girls were taken by ambulance and they were snuck in. They didn't go like the ferry takes them to the main part of the peninsula where they can go up to the house. Well, they took them to the other side where people wouldn't see them because they didn't want people to know the girls were there, because then that way they wouldn't, if they something happened to them, they died. No one knew they were there. Also, I think I failed to mention this. The girls did not want anybody to know that they were getting treatment from Linda.
Were they able to leave? Or were they
not on their own accord anymore because they couldn't even walk anymore?
Okay. So it's a physical thing, not necessarily like they were.
It's also mental at this point because they were also echoing things that Linda had said. So for Claire, the one that was more naive, she was still really thinking this was going to help her. She really still thought things were going to get better. It wasn't till the very end. When she was thinking, like, you know, something's not right or whatever. This isn't working. But for the most part, she still was kind of thinking that things were still okay. Now, the sister Dora was the one that was more skeptical. But her sister and her were really close. So she kind of was just being very supportive of her sister through this whole thing. Even in the beginning when Claire was like, oh, we really need to do this, Dora knew that that's what Claire wanted, so she was going to go along with it. So this whole time, she's kind of going along with it. But then at some point during the first couple weeks, she's like, maybe this is going to help, because they kept putting it in their head that everything was going to end up being better. Just got to get through this, and it's going to be better. And she's like, okay, this is working. I feel cleared out. And so they really were kind of on that bandwagon. But no, they couldn't really leave at that point because they were so weak. And also, when they were in the apartment, Linda said, we need to hide your jewelry. I'll put them in my safe for safekeeping. And Claire was like, I think they're okay here. This apartment seems safe. And she just said, no, no. And she would not take no for an answer anyway. She was just very persuasive. And she ended up taking $6,000, $6,000 in that time of heirloom jewelry and putting it in a safe. And that was never recovered. So she ended up also, when they were about to get on the ferry, her attorney had her change her will. So if something happened to Claire, that she would leave her money to, it was like a certain amount per year to Linda. And she was able to take some money out of her account to help pay for the sanitarium. It was like over $1,000 or something. And then changed her will to like being cremated or something, which Dora said she never would have wanted. So they think they forged part of that into that paperwork. So they did that before they left for the sanitarium. And like I said, they did not want anybody to know that they were going. So they had been visiting family all through Canada, and they were actually supposed to have gone home. She was going to go back to London and to learn how to be a kindergarten teacher. And her sister Dora was going to go visit family in Australia. So the whole family thought that that was the plan. That's what they were going to stick to. But they didn't want people to know and think that she was some, they were some type of faddist. They already had that reputation with their family, but they didn't, I guess they didn't want them to know further. So she told that to Linda in one of the letters that she didn't want family to know, which they didn't know. That was probably the worst thing to say to a killer. It's like, nobody knows we're here.
That's so true. Right?
So they end up going, and things just get worse from there because they carried Claire up to this attic. The sisters were apart still. And I guess there was cabins as well, but the sisters were apart. And then eventually they put Dora in her own cabin. But at the end, Claire just got sicker and sicker. The nurses described her as being like skeletal, just nose, like even the skin was coming off. You could see her spine through her abdomen. Yeah, it was pretty bad. And they mentioned a few times that the windows would be open. And the nurse was like, I don't know who left this window open when it was like really cold. So there's not like they barely have any sheets and blankets and stuff and no food. And they were just still doing the same treatments. The sister Claire died on May 22nd, 1911. One of the nurses had mentioned that she'd seen her hit her, like she was doing a treatment the night before, hitting her in the stomach, which, I mean, if there's no stomach there to, I mean, it does just, they said that they could hear the moaning and groaning. But yeah, so she ended up dying. And the doctor, Linda, who's for some reason was doing autopsy. She did autopsies on these people that died. Now, Claire was not the first one that had mysteriously died after doing this treatment. In fact, there was someone that had died while she was in the apartment. And over again, many of the patients that would come see them, she didn't get in trouble for any of them. One of them was a politician, and she would treat people like the mayor's father, people that were in society. And so she had this love-hate relationship with people. Like, people really either hated her or they were all about her. And it was either because someone knew someone that had done her fasting, or it was they had done it and I'm fine, you know. But again, I think it was to the point where, yeah, they must have done her fasting, but they didn't do it to a degree where these girls had done it. And so I can't remember how many days they did it. It was more than 4 weeks, though, because they got to the point where Linda was like, nope, you're still not there. We still need to keep going. So she did this autopsy on her. But when they told the uncle, and the uncle came to see the body and to see her or whatever, he said she didn't look like her. It looked like somebody else. And so they think maybe she used a different body to show the family and Dora, because they didn't want her to see how skinny she ended up getting.
Yeah.
But they did show her the organs, which were shrunken, that she took out of the body. So there was a conspiracy there, and that came up in trial, but they couldn't prove anything. Claire's diary, Linda forged that she wanted Linda to take care of Dora after she had died. Linda said she knew she was going to die. She was told within a week that she was going to die, that there was nothing she could do to save her. And so she told her that she, you know, was going to take care of Dora. Because Linda kept telling Claire Dora was insane, that something was wrong with Dora's mind, she couldn't know for sure because the sisters were kept apart. So she didn't know what was going on with Dora. She only knew from what Linda was telling her, who she had to trust because she didn't have anybody else. Or Linda would tell the nurses, and of course the nurses would believe Linda, and so they would tell Claire, yeah, your sister's gone insane or whatever. So Linda put in the book that she was to take guardianship of Dora, meaning that she could take control of the money.
Yeah.
Also, Sam had sent over to the bank a letter stating that Claire wanted some money. Well, they didn't send it to her, so he kept going into saying, where is this money and all this. He was doing that even after she had died, saying, you know, Claire's looking for this money. Well, later on, when they were doing investigation for the trial, they found that the bank didn't know that Claire had died. So they were getting money out of the bank on behalf of Claire. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Dora. So the uncle didn't know any better. He was just saying, okay, well, maybe she's supposed to be a doctor, so maybe Dora is kind of insane, and didn't take her out of there, but ended up later feeling really guilty about that. But I'll talk about that in a minute. So now she had to focus her energy on Dora, because in order to get all the money, and Dora and Claire had holdings in many countries and stocks and land and all kinds of stuff. So they were pretty wealthy. And so I'm sure this seemed like a huge win to Linda. Mm-hmm. But somehow before Claire died, she was able to get a note out to their childhood nanny, Margaret Conway. And Margaret read this note from her that seemed very mysterious and was like, I need to go see what's going on. So she came all the way from Australia to Seattle. She didn't make it in time for Claire, but saw Dora and was like completely blown away by what had happened to her.
Horrified.
Horrified. She was around 120 pounds before it all started. Oh, yeah. And she ended up being like 60 something pounds.
Oh my goodness.
So when Margaret showed up, she at first was like, take me out of here. And Dora's like, yeah, absolutely. But then it flipped the next day. Dora was like, no, no, this is a beautiful treatment. They kept saying it's a beautiful treatment, which I think is kind of like what Linda kept putting in their head. That's that cult mentality. Like, nope, this is a beautiful treatment. It's a beautiful treatment.
Dora knew that her sister had died already, or?
Dora knew. Yeah. Dora knew. And not only did she know, the doctor was trying to get her to commit suicide. She was standing at a window at one point, and Linda came rushing in like, don't jump, don't jump. And she's like, jump, I'm not going to jump. And she's like, oh, I thought you were going to try to kill yourself. And she's like, I would never think that way. That's not how my mind works or whatever. And then she talked about another patient who jumped off the gulch because of something or other. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, that's not me. And so she kept putting it in her head like, well, it would be understandable if you wanted to kill yourself after losing, you know, your dear sister, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, mm-hmm. No. So that also came up in the trial. But Margaret, she couldn't get her to leave. And then it turned out she wasn't able to get her to leave because Linda had the law on her side. Apparently she had guardianship. I guess it was that easy. Mm-hmm. She could declare her mentally incompetent, and suddenly her family was able to make her custodian. that easily. So it was really scary. But Margaret stayed on to help. She was feeding her more nutrients than they were. Like, she would have to sneak in extra things into the broth and feed it to her. And I guess she was probably more gentle when she did stuff, but it was probably really hard for her to watch her, like, because she took care of them since they were little. And so, and they were really close. So finally, she was able to sneak out a note. Now, Linda had locked the mailbox, so no mail that was coming to them was being received by them. Now, Linda had a temper. She would yell. She would hit her husband. People were afraid of her. But she had the mail locked, and she said, oh, yeah, people's mails are getting broken into, so the post office ordered the mailboxes to be locked. But then Margaret saw the mailman one day, and she said, any mail for us? And she said, yeah, right here. Gave her the mail and said, so why did they lock the boxes? And he's like, we didn't, that's not us. And so she knew that Linda had done it. Mm-hmm. When Linda found out that she had gotten the mail, she started yelling at Margaret and going off and all this other tantrum stuff. And so everybody was afraid of her, but she did get a letter off. One of the nurses had come back and was like, you need to get Dora out of here if you want her to live. She's like, yeah, I'm working on that. So she got the letter out to her uncle, who came and was going to take them away. And that's when they found out, when Linda was like, well, I have power over her. I have power of attorney over her. So you can't take her. So he ended up making a deal, giving her, I think, $1,000 to take her away. And at that time, Margaret had been putting all this stuff into her trunk, like gathering everything. Because after Claire died, Linda and the nurses were going through Claire's trunks and laughing, and like day or two after she died, and were like wearing her outfits and everything. And just wearing all her stuff around, even in front of Dora. It's pretty, pretty sad. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so she had been gathering that stuff up, waiting for the day that they could leave, including the diary, because she had shown the diary to Margaret and said, see this, you know, you need to read this. And she goes, okay, I'll read it. I'm tired right now. I'll read it later. And she goes, well, you need to read it. Well, Margaret put it in the trunk and locked it, never gave it back to Linda. Later in the trial, Linda really wanted that diary because she felt like everything wrote on that going to prove that she had a right to the money or whatever. And someone broke in to where Dora was staying and stole the diary back. And then, oh, the next day they put it into evidence. It was really crazy. Anyway, it didn't really help them anyway. Linda let them go, and then they were able to press charges from the vice consul for Britain. Well, it was very complicated because they were not U.S. citizens and because the county that the crime happened in was very poor. So they didn't want to press charges because the trial would be a lot of money. And so they're like, who's going to be paying for this? And because the money was tied up in this other battle with Dora, Dora was going to pay for the, you know, put her own money into this criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. But because of the other lawsuit with her trying to get out of being the custodian with Linda, her money was like tied up. So the vice counsel was trying to get the British government to pay for it and was trying to get the state of Washington to pay for it. And the governor wasn't helping and the county wasn't helping. And he even found two other victims that were in the British Empire that, like, don't you want to, you know, protect or to fight this woman over our British subjects being killed? Mm-hmm. And so it took a while, but they finally did arrest her for murder. And it went up and down. So the Linda, of course, was very vocal about how she hadn't done anything wrong. And the nurse, she had like a huge influence. So for some reason, these nurses backed her up, even though they later would say, you know, they were concerned or whatever. Linda had this hold on them. Like, they wouldn't be able to work anywhere else if they didn't abide by her wishes. Like, mm-hmm. she had control of their livelihood. And so that's kind of how it went. But overall, the trial showed that she did do some wrongdoing, that there was obviously some financial issues. The testimony of Margaret Conway was very influential because she was there while she was seeing the treatment of Dora and the lack of food and what she looked like. So by the time the trial came around, Dora was doing much better. They said she was so skinny when she came out, she couldn't even close her lips because they were so, like, over her teeth, because it was so, she looked like a skeleton. Everything was all, shrunken, and her eyes were bulging. But by the time the trial came around, she was doing a lot better. But they also were like, well, see, look, she looks great.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So the other thing was, some people were like, they didn't care that Linda was on trial for murder. They didn't believe any of it. And one lady, one of her big believers, came to her. She ended up dying. She ended up dying as from starvation. Wow. Right. Yeah. The other person that helped, of course, besides Dora and Margaret, was one of the nurses that had been there for a short period of time. Also, she also said what she saw, and especially after Claire had died, she described the body. But that guy Webb was told to go and get her to change her testimony. And so he's just a young, stupid kid. So he went and found her. But the family that she was working for kicked him out. Mm-hmm. Like, get out of here. You know, you leave her alone, blah, blah, blah. And so luckily that didn't scare her. Because even when she came to testify and she was in town with her friend, he came to the door to scare her and change her mind. He didn't rough her up or anything. But then on the stand, her and her friend both said, yeah, he came and tried to get her to change the testimony.
Yeah.
So they did things in not very smart way, like stealing the diary and then having it in evidence the next day, things like that. So, and then Linda was in the courtroom trying to coach the person on the stand. So one of the nurses, Nellie, was on the stand, and they said, how many times, blah, blah, blah. And so Linda would be holding up her fingers, and then they would stop the court, and the attorney would be like, got the jury out and would say, she's coaching the witness. And then, of course, they were like, don't do that anymore. You're being watched. The bailiff would sit there and watch her. It was the craziest.
Yeah.
It was the craziest court thing.
There's a joke about, like, how, you know, how, like, there's warning signs, and they're like, when you look at signs, like, oh, don't bring a chainsaw on an airplane. It's because somebody tried at one point to bring a chainsaw on an airplane, and now we need to warn, like, have a sign for it to tell people not to. And it's like, these are, you know, con men or whatever, just con artists or sociopaths, and now we have certain rules, and we're like, well, sometimes we don't appreciate how far and how important it is to record keep and everything, because they took advantage of a system, and so that system has to be constantly refined.
Yeah, one of the books I had read is called Starvation Heights. Linda called her home Wilderness Heights, but everybody else called it Starvation Heights because obviously her patients were starving to death. And sometimes they would say they would see some of her patients going down to the little store in the little village. And one of them later sent money back to the little store saying, I'm really sorry, I stole some food. And and sometimes the neighbors would give them food because they would, well, they would ask for it. They were like starving because Linda wasn't giving them food, even though in the court, she was like, no, they can have all the food they wanted. They didn't want to have any food. They were staying strong to this starvation diet or fasting diet. And so that wasn't true. And even saying, oh, no, there was milk and cheese, and they kept saying meat, but the girls are vegetarian, so they wouldn't have eaten the meat. But they kept saying that all the stuff was in their refrigerator or in their pantry or wherever. Some of the people that testified were like, nope, none of that was there. So there was a lot of contradictions Linda tried to make, and it was always the patients that were lying. It was always the patient's fault. It was the patient that didn't follow the regimen. It was the patient that this and that. Pretty crazy. It was a pretty crazy trial. But she did end up getting charged with manslaughter, which was great. And she got her license taken away. However, her sentence was 2 years to 20 years. No less than 2 years, no more than 20 years, I guess. She only served 2 years.
Wow.
They didn't charge her with any other murders because, again, the court was like, well, what? I think it's just all about money. The court didn't have the money to do all this research and into all of these different murders. But the court was like, well, she's being charged with this one, so I guess it's okay. Just like with Sam in the military, like, well, he's already in prison, so he's serving time. We won't press charges for anything else. You know, that wouldn't happen nowadays. You're like, nope, tack that on. Yeah, so she only had to serve 2 years. She went to jail, to prison, Walla Walla State Prison, in 1913 and was there until 1915, served 2 years. She lost her license to practice medicine, but again, that did not stop her. She was practicing even up until she went into jail. The country of Australia refused to allow any mail to leave its shores addressed to Linda Burfield Hazard. I didn't even know you could do that, but they didn't want any more of their citizens to die at her hands. So they refused to have mail come to her. But 6 months after she got out of jail, the freaking governor pardoned her. Pardoned her with the caveat that she had to leave the country because she had mentioned she was leaving. Didn't say for how long, but he pardoned her. I don't know. So Sam and Linda left for New Zealand after she got her pardon, and she continued to practice as a physician. That was on her door: physician, dietitian, and osteopath. She wrote another book, Diet and Disease and Systemic Cleaning. And then in 1920, they came back to the States and settled in the same place. They opened up the sanitarium, and because they had all this money from New Zealand, they were able to build the sanitarium like she always wanted. This grand place. And everybody said it was such a glorious thing to look at.
What a fairy tale.
Yeah, she's living the dream.
Living the dream. Like, oh, really? Okay. Oh, my goodness.
She really is. She never got her medical license back, but she's still practicing. And she was arrested several times, one in California for practicing without a medical license. After someone had died, they were following up on it, found that she was practicing without a license. They arrested her, but they only fined her.
And the audacity. That's what happened. It's like, you believe it. Like, she believed it. She felt grander than, like, I wonder all the labels we know now, what she fits under, like narcissist. And
she really was a narcissist. That's for sure.
Yeah.
In 1935, the Starvation Heights burnt to the ground. Now, Linda seemed very distraught about it. She was going around like, oh my God, everything's gone. Everything I worked for. Sam seemed to be really calm. They said he was kind of like off to a distance. saying things like, oh, it's insured. Because they were trying to throw out the furniture and stuff, trying to save stuff. But I guess they said something about the front door. This is a really good front door. Do you want to save it? And he's like, no, it's insured. So I'm wondering if Sam hadn't like tried to put everything up in flames, because he was always behind in the money. It was always him that was ruining things. Mm-hmm. And so maybe he was the one that started the fire because he was trying to find a way to fix things with money. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But she was devastated. And then 3 years later, she kind of felt ill. And then ironically, she gave herself the fasting cure and died.
Oh, yeah. A true fairy tale, indeed. Like, oh my goodness, what a crazy story. Well, what a crazy, yeah, just that it really did happen. And
it did. And there was about 20 people, they think, that she had killed over those years that she was practicing. Mm-hmm. That she would do the same thing as the sisters. And the sister one is pretty famous because there's a lot of details about it. There's a lot of written transcripts and things like that. And they were the only ones that went to trial. But again, that story was very familiar. Like the guy who came, I think he was from Scotland. He'd come and they would treat him. She would treat him and then take the money. She would take over his finances till there was nothing left. He died. And then they would tell the family, oh, it was because of whatever ailment he had before. It was never from starvation. There was another one that was similar, and that they were in an apartment or a hotel or something, and other people were trying to intervene. So she took him to a secret location and didn't tell anybody where he was at, and treated him, and then he ended up dying. Oh, and there was this other case. So I told you about Webb. He was the lynchman for Linda. Mm-hmm. His sister was a nurse and also working for Linda. She was treating this lady. I think it's the Andersons. I think her name is Ida Anderson. She was helping with the fasting with both the husband and the wife. But the husband wasn't so sold on it. Now the wife became a cult part of, like she became a believer. Well, it turned out she also was pregnant at the time of that first fast. Didn't realize it, I guess, until later. The baby was born, and the baby was pretty much born starved to death. Mm-hmm. So the baby died. Well, the next time the lady was pregnant, the husband was like, well, no, we're not having that nurse come back. And so the woman had the baby, and then she was doing the fast again, but they took her out of the care of that nurse, and Linda took her to the hospital. Well, she got better, but then snuck out of the hospital with the baby and went to, I don't know if it was a hotel or an apartment, but was being seen by Linda and the nurse, that Webb's sister, and ended up dying. She ended up dying of starvation. The grandmother ended up taking the baby out of there, and the baby survived, but the wife, she didn't. She starved to death.
Wow. All the needing, like when you got to protect people from themselves.
Yeah, it's pretty much how it is. I think too, when you're taking someone out of a cult.
Yeah.
You have to reprogram them, right? You have to kind of, it's not just about taking them out. You have to really work on their mentality.
Yeah. And it's a big factor. And I know there was like a really, Explained, that one show on Netflix. They have one on cults, and it was a really good episode. But a big factor in it is like looking for something to believe in, like looking for something to kind of focus your life on. Like, we want that grand idea of what we're all like, what is a life worth living? And they, so people who are feeling like that's missing from their life, they are more susceptible to believing somebody. Sad.
Yeah, it is sad. There was a lot of people that I read. I mean, I wish I could go over all of them, but it's the same story over and over again anyway. It's just different. I think there was even a monk that went to see her.
Oh, no, that's odd. Yeah.
Yeah. I just find it so amazing, too, that they went for so long on so little. Like, the body can be amazing. There was one guy who was like 225 pounds and he ended up being 100 and something. He lost a lot. He was one of the ones that had died too. But mm-hmm. there was just so like you just lose so much so fast, and that it could survive that long on so little is crazy. Mm-hmm. Listeners, please do not try that at home.
Yeah, for sure. Like, organ damage. Yeah, like, it's like, long-term effects, like a weakened heart, and it's just...
Yeah, like all of the organs just shrunk. The liver, and they were all hard. And, well, yeah, there's no... One of the... That one that was the first one that had died, Miss Young in Minneapolis, the coroner said there was practically no blood.
Wow.
There's, like, no blood in the system. Very little. So... You dehydrate someone so much that's the other thing, is if they're only getting 2 cups of broth a day, you're really not getting the water you need. So I can imagine passing out and being dizzy, and they definitely weren't doing their vigorous exercise twice a day or several times a day.
Mm-mm.
No.
Once you start to cannibalize your muscles and your brain, which I think like just a couple of days and your body's going to go after.
Yeah.
So your brain, so your mental abilities are going to go down.
So then you're more dependent on your killer. You can't do anything. It's a crazy story, but.
Yeah. Thanks. We got to look out for that kind of stuff. Like, you still got to, we still got to watch out for people like following blindly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still cults out there. There's still people doing crazy things, and people get really desperate, you know, for cures.
Yeah. Another downer. Oh.
I'll see if I could find a happier story at some point. I was gonna say I want to do a one on witches, but maybe that one end up so.
That's a cool one, but yes, that's going to be another one of 200,000 hangings. Downer,
I know.
Okay. Like something with a hero at the end.
All right.
Like, and then
we were all saved. Okay, I'll work on that.
And now, yeah.
All right. All right. Well, thanks again for being on this episode with me. And thanks, listeners, for being with us. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Happy New Year. Hope it's a good one.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed today's mental vacation from your current life. If you did and are curious for more, please subscribe. Before you go, if you have anything to add to today's show, or you have a topic that you think is worthy of dissection, please reach out on dissectingmedicalhistory.com or Instagram on dissectingmedicalhistory. Thank you, and stay curious.